Hi everyone, welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 135. I'm your host, Johnny Boy Metz.
The sexiest.
And, well...
I don't want to hear that. You two can discuss that somewhere else.
Yes, those voices you hear now are John Lindemann.
Mm-hmm.
James Jones.
Do I have to agree that that's me? Can I decline?
Go ahead.
You just said what everybody else is thinking.
And waiting in the wings is Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
There we are. And we're going to have an abbreviated show for you this week. Not that we're lopping anything off. We're just going to try to move through this a little faster than normal. We're not doing retroactive this week. That will return next time with Eternal Darkness. So dig out your discs and get cranking on that. But we're going to start off with new business today and then hit up some news. And then we will have the return of your listener mail. And thanks to everybody who wrote in. So for new business, I'm going to start off. And most of my week was spent playing Retro Game Challenge, which I already talked about at length last week. And the only other thing I'll say about it is that it does end exceptionally well. In fact, the game gets considerably better as you go. As the games get more advanced, more complex, more interesting, I think. And the one game that I had not unlocked last week when I talked about it is Robot Ninja Haggleman 3, which is markedly different from the first two. It is basically a Ninja Gaiden RPG. And with Metroid exploration, and it is completely badass. it's also surprisingly difficult. And when I say Ninja Gaiden RPG, you might assume that it would be difficult since Ninja Gaiden typically is. But the first level, and I would say part of the second level, are quite easy. But as you get towards the end of the second level, and then especially the third level, it can get brutally difficult at points. There's a lot of moving platforms over bottomless pits with birds launching at you from off screen, and you have, you know, a nanosecond to react or you die. And it has infinite continues, so, you know, it's not that bad. But, man, it's a beautiful game. I love it, and it is only one of eight included in this package. So having completed all eight games now, some of them with the help of cheat codes, which is part of playing the game. I mean, it gives you the cheat codes, so you are expected to use them in some cases. It's a brilliant package, and I very highly recommend it to everyone, especially if you're old enough to have played some NES games back in the 80s, because the game is really designed for you. But even if you're just kind of curious about that era of time, I think it's quite worthy. But yeah, I mean, I was listening to another podcast, I think the Combo Breaker podcast, which is from combo.com. That's Combo with a K. Go figure. And they had John Davison as a guest on their podcast. My friend Sean O'Neill turned me onto that because he works at that site. And John Davison was talking about this game. Of course, he's in the game. His photos and likeness are in the game in a very minor way. But he was saying it's funny because even though he's in the game, he doesn't have that much nostalgia for this kind of thing because the NES really wasn't a factor in the UK. And so
not at the time that he would have been a younger guy, especially. I think it caught on a bit more later, but you're talking about the very end of the 80s or more like the early 90s.
Right. And that was really the Mega Drive's time to shine.
Yeah, well, the Mega Drive took longer to get here, and then when it did, that was a really big deal.
Yeah, so he was just commenting that even, it's funny, because even though he's actually in Retro Game Challenge, playing through the game is interesting for him because he doesn't really have that much nostalgia for those games. And it just reminded me of the kind of culture thing that we talked about last week where it might explain why this game currently has not been announced for the European territory.
Also, I mean, there would be significant localization issues with all the other territories as well. Like, you know, I mean, the UK is one thing, and you have sort of the Davison example illustrates the barriers there, but I mean, all the other countries.
Like Germany.
Spain, definitely. France, you know. It's
they can't afford games in Spain. What are you talking about? Crippling poverty.
And Nintendo's actually really popular in Spain. Go figure. But having played through the entire game now, and I'm sure I'm going to keep it in my DS case because this is the kind of thing I'll pull out at the airport and, you know, try to finish Guadia Quest for real instead of skipping to the ending, which is what I did. playing through it really made me excited for the sequel, which just came out this week, I believe, in Japan, Game Center CX2. And I've watched a few videos of it, but just now you're starting to get some like real coverage of it. I think 1UP has had a little bit. Chris Kohler put up his first impressions, and I'm really, really, really excited for the sequel. And unfortunately, it's not import-friendly at all. I mean, one of the games in the sequel is a graphical text game, or like a text adventure game. Yeah. Like, I don't even know what to compare it to on the NES, except for maybe Shadowgate and Deja Vu, things like that. Maybe Gogol 13. But yeah, it sounds awesome. So I'm really hoping that Retro Game Challenge does well, and XSEED will see fit to bring over the sequel as well, because I'm a big fan, for sure.
Yeah, XSEED's really bringing over some cool games. They really are. Like, they're bringing over some stuff that nobody else would really take a chance on, like, you know, like Korg DS10, just crazy stuff like that. So, they're pretty impressive.
Did you get that yet, John?
I mean,
that was one of your big games.
Yeah, I did get it, but that's actually, I mean, it's a real musical instrument. I've never been really good at learning real musical instruments. So, it's kind of sad there. I'm kind of scared of it. But
that's how I felt at E3. I was like, this shit is, like, intimidating.
Yeah, it's like the game in theory is probably better than in practice for unless you're, you know, willing to actually tap it out and really, really use it and sit down with it.
Yeah.
One day, man, one day.
One day, yeah. It's like you're like every other guy with a guitar in the corner of his bedroom as I look at mine right now, and I know about 3 chords on it. So I could play Tom Petty. But anyway... the only other game I've really played this week is Stubbs the Zombie, which I rented from Gamefly. This is an old Xbox game that was developed by Wideload, which was a studio that split off from Bungie after they made Halo. And this game is nothing like Halo, or else I wouldn't have bothered with it. But it's a third-person action game, and it's very highly acclaimed. You know, other than that, I didn't know a lot about it, except you play as a zombie. And... I mean, having played it for a few hours now, it's definitely a last-generation game, and it has that kind of feel to it, but there's a lot of fun to be had with it, and I think the concept is really hilarious. So it takes place in 1959, and it's oddly similar to Bioshock, actually, the setting, but it takes place in this sort of utopian experimental city that this rich entrepreneur has built, and... Even though the game takes place in 1959, this rich guy has built the city to be like the city of the future. So it's all like faux retro futuristic shit. Like really clunky looking Jetson-style robots roaming the street and hover cars that are clearly supported by columns of air, which would be the most inefficient thing you can imagine.
What do you think?
It's a really interesting setting. And then on opening day of this city, like the day the city opens to the public and they're showing off everything, this couple is having a picnic in the park, and all of a sudden Stubbs the zombie climbs up out of the ground and eats their brains. And so it's a really unusual environment to be playing around in. And the thing I really like about it is that it doesn't play like I expected it to, in that one of the major mechanics is that you go around and you feed on the hapless civilians and the cops who come and chase after you and shoot you and, you know, this and that. You're eating all these people's brains, and as you do, they fall down and die, and then about 10 seconds later they climb up and now they're your zombie army. And they follow you around and they distract the other enemies while you sneak around behind them and eat their brains. So you play through these kind of segments of the game where you're building up this army of zombies who just create havoc all around you. They sort of follow you, but they'll also go ahead of you and pave the path for you and kind of prepare things. But then inevitably you get to some door or some cutscene happens that basically cuts you off from your army of zombies, and you enter a new area all by yourself, and you kind of have to start over again. So it's an interesting game. I have a feeling it's going to be kind of short-lived, but that's fine, especially as a rental. But the graphics hold up really nicely, and like I said, it is hilarious in certain places, that's for sure. So I'm having a good time with it. Sounds like you guys don't have a lot to say about Stubbs the Zombie.
I do have one comment. Doesn't it have some bizarre-ass subtitle?
Rebel Without a Pulse.
Yeah, that's it. Stubbs the zombie in Rebel Without a Pulse.
That gives you a good idea of what the game is really like.
It almost seems like ahead of the curve because the amount of zombie games now that are like really big, like Left 4 Dead and all that, Dead Rising a few years ago and stuff like that, it just seems like it's the natural thing to do is to play as a zombie more you know, specifically.
Speaking of Left 4 Dead, the game is actually available on Steam.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can get it on the marketplace if you have a 360.
You mean Stubbs the Zombie is?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't even know there was a PC version.
Yeah, there's actually a Mac version, too.
Oh, that's interesting. I guess that makes sense coming from guys with a Bungie background.
Yeah. I remember there was a big deal about this game because it was being built with the Halo engine, but in the end it turned out to be more of a crutch than it was a benefit because apparently the Halo engine wasn't very easy to develop for, even if you were on the team that built the damn thing.
Well, I mean, it doesn't play anything like Halo, that's for sure. So anyway, that's the end of my new business. And James is next.
So I really haven't been playing much this week. I've been pretty busy. But besides a lot of old stuff that I've talked about a few times, I just wanted to point out to John that we were in our discussion of Soul Calibur 4 last week, in lieu of the fact that he picked the version that would prevent me from beating him savagely.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You can, in fact, get past the overpowered Star Wars characters.
Oh, so you finally did it?
It took me 37 tries.
Oh, that's retarded.
It is. It's ridiculous. And you know what's worse? He's not the boss.
Now who is?
And the boss is that crazy-ass, like, bipolar god thing with the red and blue hands.
His name. See, the funny thing
easy.
Is, yeah, that's the whole thing. I didn't have any problem beating him.
I got past the apprentice, and then I beat Algol in one try.
Yeah. I mean, Algol's a
including
joke.
Including one perfect match.
Yeah.
So, I really just want to point out that I really think my theory that they intentionally made the Star Wars characters more powerful simply because of the deal with Lucas is now completely confirmed.
Yeah, I think so.
I think it is completely confirmed.
Yep.
It's hard to argue with that.
Yeah. That's really all I played this week.
Okay. So, John Lindemann, you are next.
You know, I actually have an uncanny amount of stuff to talk about this week, actually.
Oh, God.
Wicked.
Well, to start off with...
You downloaded Onslaught and a bunch of Commodore 64 shit.
I wouldn't say a bunch, Johnny. I think that's a little bit of hyperbole on your part.
He still has the originals.
There was only three games that came out.
Yeah, I actually do have the... I wouldn't say they're the original copies of the Commodore 64 games that were released this week, but let's just say I have copies of them. And I.
That sounds shady.
So, yeah, it is
Go
shady.
Ahead.
Shadiness confirmed. I downloaded The Last Ninja, which I think was released in 1987, and it was developed by System 3, and I think that they're either a UK developer or an Australian developer, I can't remember, but they were one of the big Commodore 64 development houses at the time. They were really, really good.
Wasn't that part of a series?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, 2 and 3 are out on the European Virtual Console, so I imagine you could expect those to come to America in time.
Yeah.
Were they named The Last Ninja and The Last
no,
Ninja?
No, unfortunately they were.
By the way, Ninja games set a bad example for children.
They do. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, they really
the
do.
Worst
they
kind
they
of example.
They wouldn't even let the turtles be called Ninja Turtles in Britain. They were the Hero Turtles.
Are you serious?
Yes.
No, that's completely true.
Oh,
yep, 100% true. Yep, the Hero Turtles.
Yeah, and they had to cut, I think they cut a certain amount of stuff out with the guy that used the nunchucks, because they were, very taboo.
That's Michelangelo, and he is a party dude.
He is a party dude, and he likes ice cream pizza, yes? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes, they had to completely rewrite the intro song then.
Yeah, they did. No, they did.
What a shame.
It was the full deal. They went to the effort to protect British children.
I'm mildly curious about seeing that intro song now after we finish recording. So, John, how is The Last Ninja? I was not impressed by the screenshots I saw.
No,
it's
well,
the last
okay.
One.
You know, it's
you were not impressed by the screenshots of a Commodore 64 game.
This isn't what
game.
I was expecting at all. I expected something that at least competed with the Nintendo 64.
Well played, sir. Well played.
64-bit versus 64K. What's the difference? Come on.
It might look better than some Jaguar games. It's not out of the question.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
Go on, John.
Well, yeah, the thing is, you know, it's, I mean, I have a soft spot in my heart for Commodore 64 games, but I mean, if you didn't grow up with them, it's like the Atari 2600. If you never played it, you would play it today and just say that this looks completely ass. And just like you would play probably almost any Commodore 64 game aside from maybe a couple, and it looks completely ass. So what I'm saying is that the game pretty much looks ass, but...
Can I interrupt everyone here for a second?
Go ahead.
During that John's discussion about the graphics, I was experiencing some really terrible lag, so all I heard was the word ass repeated ad nauseum.
Yeah, me too.
That's all you need
ass.
To know.
John, turn off Steam and AIM and everything else,
yeah,
please.
Yeah, but you press stop on that Requiem for a Dream DVD, for God's sake.
He can't resist Jared Leto.
No, I just can't.
All right. Okay. How does it play? I have to know now. I didn't give a shit before, but the tension's killing me.
Seriously.
Well, it's tough now. It's... Maybe I should just move on to Onslaught.
No,
John.
John,
for God's sake.
Okay, it is an action game. It is a ninja game. You're trying to kill a shogun. Let's see. The graphics are very pixelated, and they're lower res than you would see on a NES game. So probably people today won't really appreciate it.
Is it the best in shogun?
It's very difficult. You'll find that a lot of it's like you have to bring your character right up next to something. Like, if you have to pick up a key, it's virtually impossible to pick it up because you actually have to have your character's pixels touching it. It's really
sexy.
A difficult game. It's one of those games that's it's punishingly difficult. It's like if you want an old school game, that's it. All right, moving on to Onslaught. Onslaught, it's a decent first person shooter. It's very stripped down graphics wise. They kind of take the shortcut of having everything set on a Mars-like planet, so they never really have to have any detail anywhere. Everything is just kind of a lot of sand and a lot of rocks and a lot of stuff like that. But I mean, in that sense, it looks okay. It doesn't look bad at all.
I'm correct in thinking that nothing really shoots back at you. It's not like you're shooting at guys who are shooting back at you, right?
It's a bug hunt, right? So
it's more like a shooting gallery.
Exactly.
On foot.
Yeah, it's more like, you know, it could easily be turned into an on rails light gun game, kind of like that kind of thing. It could easily be turned into that.
Yeah, that is so not interesting to me. Sorry.
Yeah, it's. And, you know, it's very much like that because the way the game is structured is you have, like, it's like kind of like an arcade mode where you have, an area that you just walk all the way through, and the bugs come up, you kill them. It's exactly like a shooting gallery.
That's like my kitchen.
Yep, exactly.
Like your kitchen.
It's like James's kitchen. Walking right through it. And the online stuff, the Wi-Fi stuff is pretty cool. You can play through the arcade part with, I think, three other people, which is kind of neat, just trying to go, I think, for like the highest score or best time or something. I've only played it a couple times. And then you also have, you can play like a death match against three other people. So in terms of, you know, it's actually more fully featured for a WiiWare title than I thought it would be. Like, definitely, I mean, even though it's kind of stripped down, I mean, Hudson definitely didn't just take the easy way out, you know. They actually did. I mean, it's something that you can play for a while. I don't necessarily know if it's worth $10, but
it's pushing the size limit pretty hard, isn't it? It's like over 300 blocks. They're fitting everything they can with it.
Yeah, it's 309 blocks.
That doesn't surprise me at all, though. Considering
no,
the kind of game it is.
No, it doesn't. But I mean, that, you know, it does. Unfortunately, that will always sort of count against it for me. It better be bloody good if it's gonna cost that.
Oh
anymore.
Well, yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, it's amazing that they managed to get anything working. That's like 37 megabytes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No.
How do you make a? I mean, even if it does look like an N64 game, you know, like most N64 first-person shooters came in at not much less than that.
Yeah,
and then this one's got a little bit of voice and higher, you know, somewhat higher resolution, and online code of some kind. It's pretty impressive that they crammed it all in there.
I like that we described online code for Nintendo games as, quote, online code of some kind.
Well, yeah. So, John, anything else for you, man?
No, that's about it on the Nintendo side. I still haven't touched GTA Lost in the Damned, so that's it.
Okay, cool. Well, Greg is going to wrap it up for us on new business.
Okay, a couple of things I want to get to. I did finally manage, I've been looking for one for quite a while, but I got a really, really nice condition box copy of Metroid 2 for the Game Boy. Yeah, this is something I wanted to play for a long time because I'm a big, big Metroid fan. Just wanted to play all the different entries in the series. This has been in polls for the retroactive feature, and it may well feature in the future, so I won't get into it too much detail in it, but just played a little of it so far, and I find it quite a lot more playable than the original Metroid. I've tried to play that a couple of times because of the gag about it being available and everything. but a couple of times I was like, well, you know, like with Zero Mission, it's like, oh, well, now I've got it portable. You know, I'll give it a chance. And that is a tough game to try and play, the original Metroid, isn't it? It's just so...
It is.
Restrictive. And
there's a reason that they remade it with Zero Mission and they haven't tried to remake Metroid 2.
Yeah,
I don't think it needs it as much.
Well, the first thing about Metroid 2 that's more sort of just, you know, feels better is the ability to shoot in more directions. You know, you could shoot up as well as to the side, and while jumping you could shoot down. You know, which is something that you usually tend to do in the latter Metroids and stuff. So it just feels a bit more like the other Metroids in that sense, you know, because I don't know, something kind of almost sort of Ghosts and Goblins-y about the original Metroid because it's so restrictive, you know. It just does. But yeah, I guess that's the way it was with 8-bit games. I mean, was Kid Icarus kind of the same?
It was
difficult.
Kid Icarus is basically the same as Metroid except shittier
and up.
It's got different level structures. You got three different kinds of levels or something, like one goes up, one goes across, and then something else. I don't know. Well, I was thinking about getting that for the Japanese Virtual Console out of curiosity, and apparently it's the Famicom Disk System version, which means the music is somewhat better because it had an extra channel. But I don't know, if it's a lot like NES Metroid, then that's going to be, in terms of the kind of gameplay as well as like the graphics and all that, obviously pretty much the same in a lot of ways, then I don't know whether I'd want to. But yeah, so that's the good thing about Metroid 2. I guess the biggest problem with it is just your view area is so tiny. It's kind of an issue because of like the Samus sprite is very big on screen, pretty impressive for a 91 Game Boy game, and even animates quite well in certain ways.
Yeah, technically it's an impressive game.
But what that means is that you don't really see very much, and then so if you sort of jump and then you're falling down a kind of Metroid style, you know, traditional kind of Metroid vertical kind of cavern, and there's like little platforms in the middle with those what they call like zoomers or whatever that kind of crawl around. It's so easy to just jump and, oh, I've hit one, that's hurt me, you know, and you had no way of avoiding it because you couldn't see it. You know, it's as simple as that. Right. So it's a kind of inherent issue with the game. Other than that, I haven't really gotten far enough into it to comment further. Obviously, it does have a fundamentally different structure from a lot of the Metroids.
Greg, would you say it's easier than the first Metroid?
It's certainly easier just to play. I mean, I haven't played enough of it to say it's easier overall as a game, but it's kind of easier on your brain in terms of like Metroid's just more frustrating. It's so clunky.
I feel like they figured it out a little bit between the two games.
Yeah, like I said, the greater directionality of the shooting, and I think Samus is almost too small in Metroid. You know, the original Metroid, like she feels. The environments are so sort of big, but you can only like shoot in this, especially you know, before you've powered yourself up in this tiny little sort of area of it. It's just an issue. So I think it's easier to get into. I don't know how. I mean, Johnny, would you say it's a tough game, Metroid 2 later?
Metroid 2, no. I think some of the very final Metroids are very difficult, but for the most part. No, I think it's much easier than the first one.
Yeah,
it's a really brilliant game. I'm glad you found a copy, Greg.
Yeah, it's something you wanted to do for the longest time, but it's excellent condition and it was very reasonably priced. So I'm glad about that, and maybe we will talk about it more one day. I don't know. But the other thing I've been playing is for the Japanese Virtual Console, Super Darius 2.
This super
is
derived.
It's super derived because it was a sort of enhanced, in some ways, conversion of the arcade game Darius. Now, the arcade Darius are famous for being played on arcade cabinets that had, like, multiple screens, so it was, like, this widescreen setup.
Mm-hmm.
And so, being converted to home console, you lose all that extra real estate.
Can I ask, is there any appreciable reason why a Taito shooter was named after a Persian emperor?
No idea. I'll get to the content of the game in terms of my baffling.
Okay.
Now, which system is this on?
Yeah, this is the PC Engine CD or the Turbo CD. It looks pretty good. Like I said, everything seems a bit big because I guess you are just seeing pretty much one screen of the three. Like, I don't think they've really adjusted it that much. So you've just pretty much taken away that horizontal sort of real estate that you had in the arcade. So everything's pretty big and chunky on screen. And, you know, sometimes it does feel a little bit cramped with the enemies and all that, but it's not that hard or anything as a result. It seems all right. And the thing about the Darius games is that they have they have branching paths, and in this one end up with a lot of branching paths. So you end up with a lot of levels, but the thing is the level design is so kind of bland that it's not really that noticeable. I mean, they really are just like, in terms of the environments, there's really nothing to them. And then the enemy patterns aren't particularly imaginative. But what you do get is different bosses. Everything has different bosses. And,
yeah, cool bosses.
And they're pretty cool. So the thing about Darius is all like marine robot bosses, like crustaceans and fish and all sorts of crazy stuff. And some of them are just visually kind of funny. And they have this great intro. This great intro is like, comes up in big blocky text on the screen, like, warning, massive battleship. And it has a serial number. And then it has some name. Like, this one boss, which I think is absolutely brilliant, is called the Vengeance Shark. And then it says, approached fast. In a nice bit of English.
Well, it's a shark. I mean, holy shit, it's going to be fast.
But, like, it's basically like the base equivalent of an aircraft carrier, except it's a shark. It's just awesome. And it's, like, got loads of tiny little, like, spaceships flying off its back, and, like, little turrets on its back and everything. But, like, yeah, on the front, it's this big shark face. And so it's just brilliant, though. It's so crazy. It's actually,
oh, my God. I'm looking at it right now, and it's a good
boss battle as well, and there's lots of them that are quite sort of funny like that. So that really, the bits in between, you know, basically the levels are kind of totally forgettable and just like kind of like parades. So it could almost have been more like was it Alien Soldier for Treasure that was basically a game all of boss battles.
It's all bosses.
It might have been better just stripping it down like that, but I guess because of its arcade roots, you'd never do that because you've got to kind of drag it out in the arcade, haven't you, to extract people's quarters. And it's got the, I think I've mentioned this before I actually had it, but it's got this CD soundtrack that's so cheesy. It's epically cheesy. It's not really like Lords of Thunder cheesy. It's kind of a different kind. It's more like 80s movie cheesy, you know what I mean? Like, not so much like
there's
metal.
There's like a high Hasselhoff factor to it.
I wouldn't say it's quite that bad.
That's what she
it's
said.
Not quite Hasselhoff.
It's
maybe.
Like, I don't know, like some of these iffier sort of 80s productions that were like sort of relied on synth a lot for their scores with a bit of guitar mixed in, a bit like that. Some of it's pretty good. Some of it's not bad. I mean, some of it's all right. And the soundtrack was actually new because the arcade wouldn't have had a soundtrack that good, but because it was a CD game, so we have to show it off. So that's what they did with it. But, you know, it's kind of fun. It gives you something a bit different because it is so geared around the bosses, whereas, you know, so a lot of shooters, I don't know, the bosses sometimes kind of feel a bit token. Like, you know, it's just like, well, you got to have something big and impressive at the end, but they're not necessarily that interesting. So it's nice to have them be a really big part of the game because I really like that. But, I don't know. It's whether we'll ever see any of these kinds of games outside of Japan is kind of debatable.
Well, I know that Darius Twin for Super Nintendo was released in America.
Oh yeah, the game on the Super NES, but I mean Virtual Console. It just seems like, you know, like Hudson were the people that were really pushing like loads of shooters, and they've like changed their strategy with regard to stuff on the Wii Shop channel in America, is like they're doing stuff like Onslaught for WiiWare and are not really like releasing virtual console games so much. I mean, recently they've said, you know, oh no, we haven't like literally completely stopped doing them forever, even though like they haven't released one since October, I think.
What, you mean flooding the entire system with shooters wasn't a good business strategy?
Yeah, well, like I said, if you think they were flooding it, you know, they flooded the Japanese world with so much more, and they're quite content to keep doing it over there. So that's what I'm saying, is that, you know, if they're not doing that in North America and Europe, then we're probably not going to get a game
It was supply and demand. Hudson had them in great supply and demanded Nintendo post them.
Yep.
Well, I guess that's going to wrap up our new business, and then before the break, we're going to jump right into a news roundup. It's oddly enough, but it's the last week of February, and we've got even more news coming out. So February's been a weird month. We've had a lot of big game releases, and then a lot of news announcements at the same time, and normally it's like one of the worst, most boring months for video games. So the most recent announcement is that Punch-Out got a release date. This is the Wii revival, of course, of Punch-Out. And in North America, it's going to be out on May 18th. But other than that, Nintendo didn't say anything new about it.
Yeah, it was like the press release was so like, oh yeah, you'll fight old favorites and new characters. I mean, it was so seemingly sort of deliberately bare of new details, although that lends credence to the idea that it really is like almost a remake kind of game, you know, that it isn't going to provide a lot of additional content.
I'm just hoping for a good online mode. I really, really am.
I'm not sure. It would be quite an undertaking to make Punch-Out work online.
You think?
Well,
yeah, it definitely could be.
Because it's fundamentally a one-player game. In its original form, you could adapt it to a multiplayer game. I'm sure you could, but you know, it's not as simple as like, oh, let's just, you know, like with Mario Kart or something. I was like, let's just put it online.
Mm-hmm.
It would require sort of a tweaking of the game design to work in a multiplayer context. And a lot of the prevailing kind of thought in the gaming media out there is that, you know, it isn't that. I'm not sure where that belief has come from, but you know, stuff like this sort of kind of lends a certain substantiation to it.
Well, it's weird. I mean, the game's coming out in 3 months. We still don't know anything about it. But we do know more about Punch-Out than we do about Excitebots, which is a new game that was announced. And this is the follow-up. This is from Monster Games. It's the follow-up to Excitetruck, which means I am incredibly excited for it, and at the same time, kind of mystified that it's coming out April 20th, which almost sounds like a joke.
I know.
But it's coming out April 20th, and they didn't even give any screenshots today when they announced it.
Don't worry about it. It's fine.
No, it is remarkable, you know, that we've had, you know, you think
bizarre
about some of the games that we've known about for a while, Sin of Punishment 2, which they haven't given a date for. Was it like Mario & Luigi 3 that has still haven't given a Western date for? But this has been announced, and it's like, it's coming out in 2 months. Less than 2 months.
Yeah.
It's so sudden.
I don't know, the
yeah.
way these things were announced, it felt like Nintendo didn't want to announce them, but they had their hand forced somehow.
Mm.
And I'm not sure what the explanation there is, but it was a bizarre, almost a stealth announcement, you know, for the new Excitetruck. Well, I mean, we know the name of it is Excitebots, so
yeah.
I don't know what that means. Maybe they transform between bikes and trucks and snowmobiles.
Yeah,
it does
sort of sound like a Transformers knockoff from the 80s, like GoBots or whatever. But
so
maybe that
That's
is
cool.
kind of some of what's going on, is it is actually going to be different kinds of vehicles for different situations.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's cool with me, as long as it's still as much fun as Excitetruck. What we do know is it seems to be kind of geared towards families, which to me says multiplayer, and thank God, because Excitetruck had terrible multiplayer.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm totally cool with that. It would be, you know, Excitetruck would have been a great multiplayer game. It wasn't. I'm glad that they took that focus for the follow-up. It supports the Wii Wheel. That's certainly no surprise at all. I mean, Excitetruck was the first motion-controlled racing game on Wii, and Mario Kart was basically following in its footsteps, so hardly a surprise that they're going back to that idea. I think it worked quite well the first time around. It's going to have mini games, not, not too excited about that, but
yeah, that's par for the course. What that means.
Yeah. But the title is Excitebot's Trick Racing. That's basically what we know so far, but I don't know. I mean, in some sense, I'm a little anxious because of the way it was announced, you know, that maybe this is like really like a third tier release for Nintendo. They don't really care about it. Maybe they don't think it's very good. But at the same time, I love Excitruck. So, yeah. You know, 2 years in the making, I can't help but be really pumped up for this.
Is it actually being done by Nintendo?
No, it's being done by Monster Games, who made Excitruck.
We can be pretty sure that it's Monster Games, because we knew from previous reports that they were working on something for a couple of years.
Nintendo.
It must be. I mean, not that the press release independently confirmed that or anything, but it just, you know.
It doesn't independently confirm anything. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's Monster Games.
I wasn't particularly sort of like someone who really wanted to play Excitruck, but it was during the kind of the drought at the time, in 2007, and I got it for a reasonable price, and it just really won me over with how great it was. I mean, it was a really good game, and I just hope they can build on that without maybe watering it down too much or something, you know, with this whole the whole family angle is quite different from what we had before.
It is.
So,
yeah.
But
that could turn out badly, but it could be.
But
good.
Then again, I mean, that might be a bit more talk than actual substance. Also, in terms of that, might just be how they're going to try and present it.
Yeah.
And in terms of them like being so quiet about it, I mean, they were so quiet about Wario. I mean, that was like what, 3 months before it was released or something. And
that's true. They were quiet about it after it came out.
That was a fantastic
game.
Exactly, great game, absolutely great game. So, I mean, that if it follows that precedent, it would be fine.
All right. Well, we also found out in the same release that the Legend of Starfy is finally coming out to America. It's going to be called The Legendary Starfy. This is a series that started on GBA. Actually, it was one of the early GBA games in Japan. And the franchise continued for years with numerous sequels, and none of them ever came to America. It was very considered one of the more import-friendly Nintendo games on portable, because it's a very simple platformer. I think it's meant to be similar to Kirby.
But
for whatever reason, they never brought it to America, and now they finally are. And the version we're getting, it's a DS game. It's coming out in June, and it's based on a localization of the fifth Starfy game in Japan, which came out I guess recently. I'm not even sure if it's out yet in Japan.
No, it was the middle of last year, actually. It'll be about a year between the two, but. I think if it is indeed, again, the press release doesn't really confirm this, but from the description, it sounds like it is referring to the fifth one, which came out in 2008. And I guess the thing about this that's kind of interesting is it just kind of lends more and more credence to the idea that they're just padding the DS lineup, you know, like we've had remakes and they're getting around to localizing things that they haven't been localizing before. You know, it does seem like they're kind of playing out the string a bit here, and I mean, that lends more. To me, that just leaves it more open that there will be really significant DSi exclusive, whether it be digital download or the possibility of a retail game or games. That there has to be something big in that, because I mean, it's been a long time now, you know, since Nintendo did something really, really significant. We've got Mario and Luigi coming, but that's about it, and Rhythm Heaven finally. But again, that's a year-old game in Japan.
Right, and Mario and Luigi 3 is an outside developer.
Yeah, it's Alpha Dream, yeah. So you've got that to consider.
In terms of what Nintendo's doing internally,
we don't know
anything except DSiWare.
And of course, Starfy series is actually one of the few sort of series that Tosei, the so-called ninja developer, actually openly develops. It's basically theirs.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's cool. So it's interesting, and I'm glad Starfy's finally coming out. I find it, I don't want to sound negative, but I find it a little hard to really care, just because Starfy is something that I was really interested in 5-6 years ago when it first came out on GBA, but like at this point, I haven't spent any time thinking about Starfy in a long time, and and I think also it's been around long enough in Japan that you know, we kind of know it's not an amazing game or anything. So it's not like a, you know, the best kept secret or, you know, the ultimate import game or something like that. It's just, you know, good, I guess. And that's fine. But it's not the most exciting announcement for me, just, you know, because of that.
I mean, do you think it says anything in terms of maybe coming out with a new DS? I mean, I know they're coming out with the DSi, but they really seem to be playing out pretty much.
That pretty much nixes it for a while, doesn't it? Especially, especially when you consider the price point. I mean, if you had another DS after that quite soon after, how high is that going to be? $200 or what? I mean,
$7,000.
You can't get away.
I say you're good till 2011. I think 2011 we get the new DS.
Yeah,
I mean, I would be inclined to agree. It may well be somewhat a function of how well the DSi does, it sort of on its own back in terms of the digital side, the DSi exclusive with using the camera and stuff. You know, if that stuff kind of doesn't really make an impact and it's kind of like that didn't really work, then maybe we'll see a new DS sooner. I still think it's kind of puzzling the answer of where are the handheld games. You know, like, you know, I think we can be sure they're not being held over for 2011, so where are they? You know, I mean, Skip have been churning out art style games like nobody's business in Japan, but other than that, we don't really know.
It's a big question right now. What are any of Nintendo's internal teams working on? And you know, maybe as of E3, we'll know. But on any system right now, we don't really know what they're making.
Well, I mean,
I suppose
even possibly GDC could shed some light on something. Possibly, I mean, it's going
to
be
good, but I've been around this business too long to get my hopes up about GDC.
No, I mean, because that's not the purpose of it, really. I mean, it has been sometimes hijacked for that sort of thing. Like, wasn't Gears 2?
And knowing that E3 is back in full force this year,
yeah,
I don't think companies are going to be using GDC as quite the platform for announcements that they did last year.
If Nintendo have a DSi bombshell to drop, they could do that just days before the actual system comes out.
What would the bombshell be? It's already been out for a while in Japan.
Software.
Yeah. Maybe.
Okay, well, anyway, that's Starfy. no, it's quite a contentious game for a little innocent starfish guy. But, I think Greg pointed out a really interesting thing about the announcements today and the updated release list that they gave that basically goes through the end of June, which is the very notable omission of Wii Sports Resort, which we expected to be out in the April-May period not too long ago.
That's what we've been led to believe. And, I mean, if you think about last year, when were Nintendo's big titles, Wii Fit, Mario Kart Wii, both with, you know, some sort of peripheral, was in April and May. So it seems like a lock, right? That's just going to be this year's, you know, Wii Fit or Mario Kart's going to fulfill the same space. We've known about it for longer than Excitebots and Punch-Out and all that, you know. So it just seemed natural. And, of course, EA have confirmed that they're going to have stuff like Grand Slam Tennis and the next Tiger Woods are going to be Motion Plus compatible. And they're slated to come out in June. So one would think, well, it's going to come out before that, right? So I don't know.
You would think so. But, I mean, it could, if it's just Motion Plus compatible, they could pull an
expansion pack kind of deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, where they just release the accessory first. That would be quite interesting. I don't really see that happening.
No, that's not what I meant. I meant they could release the game. EA could release their game knowing that the Motion Plus isn't out there yet.
And also, I mean, how happy would you be about that? You know, that's what's going to sell Motion Pluses to people. And then they may want more games that, you know, if it feels so good, they think, oh, I need more games that use this because it's so great. You know, that's how you're going to generate sales of EA Sports games. And then if it wasn't to come out beforehand, that's really going to sort of blunt their impact, isn't it? So it must be, I would assume it must be, but why don't we know about it? Why haven't they given us a date? I mean, it just seems really odd to me.
Yeah, it makes you wonder where they're going to slot it in this year. You know, I mean, is it going to be their Christmas game or something? Or would it be pushed out that far?
I don't think
that would be far too late.
That's a long way.
That, I mean, EA would be really annoyed then, wouldn't it? You know, when their games are on the market for the better part of half a year.
Remember Conduit's coming out in June as well, and that's supposed to support Motion Plus, although I don't know what for. but it's supposed to support it.
No, didn't they finally say that they didn't in the end?
Really?
In the end, they said, oh, we investigated.
I would totally believe that, because it never made sense in
the
first
place.
Yeah, in the end,
I think they said, oh, well, we investigated it, and we did some experiments, but we didn't do it, which, like you said, yeah, that makes us so... I mean, they have Excitebots in April, and then they've got Punch-Out in May, which is kind of a bit... But, you know, they're not so big that they kind of, push it anywhere.
I think they're just waiting to announce it for June, and maybe they're gonna, that is the kind of thing it would make sense to talk more about at GDC, because it affects other developers.
Certainly. Yeah.
Well, the last story that we got this week is that Classic Controller Pro is gonna be released this summer in Japan. This is an upgraded version of the Classic Controller for Wii that has grips on each side, more like a GameCube controller, I guess you could say, or a PlayStation controller. Everything is kind of spaced out a little more, so I guess we're thinking that it's a wider controller, is that right?
It looks like. You could certainly see that the analog sticks are further apart, so it kind of suggests that the whole thing is a bit broader.
That's a good move on their part.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
The Z buttons, on the Classic Controller, there are two Z buttons. There's a ZL, or Z left, and Z right. And they were very small, clicky buttons that are really far in on the original. They're kind of hard to reach. You have to really extend your index finger out past the normal L and R buttons to get them. And so on the new one, these are going to be pretty much the same size as the L and R buttons. And now they're stacked above them. So it's more like the shoulder buttons on the PS2, PS3, and Xbox controllers. Mm-hmm. So now you basically have two shoulder buttons on each side. It sounds like it'll make it a lot more accessible, but at the same time, how many games use those buttons?
The big thing in the context of it in Japan, I understand that Monster Hunter is essentially the default control scheme for Monster Hunter 3 is the Classic Controller. In some ways, this is the Monster Hunter controller, probably. It's probably like, let's make a version of it that seems more like a sort of a real controller, if you'll forgive that phrase. And
so the funny thing is, they're calling it the Classic Pro, but they're actually just modernizing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
making it more like modern controllers and less like a classic controller.
Exactly, and I think that's the point, is that, that it'll be people who play Monster and it'll be sort of more comfortable in Japan, it'll be more comfortable to play something than it is more like I think they were doing bundles, they're porting one of the old Monster Hunters, they were doing bundles with the original classic controller already, so it's almost a lock that they're going to bundle it with this new one when they do the third Monster Hunter.
Well, that makes sense.
So whether we'll see it over in the West is another matter, I guess, because if it is like...
Well, it's imminently importable, though.
Oh, yeah. I probably will get one, because A, it's good for Geometry Wars, and B, it's good for Tatsunoko versus Capcom, because it's still got that lovely...
Good for Brawl?
Yeah, it'd be good for Brawl, good for but Brawl. I'm happy with the GameCube pad with that, because you got Rumble with the GameCube.
Yeah, I feel kind of weird using GameCube controller for Brawl. I usually play, when I did play Brawl, long ago, I usually use the Classic. But I think my favorite development on the Classic Pro is that the cord now comes out of the top instead of the bottom.
Yeah, I always enjoyed the Dreamcast rear-ass control, but...
Yeah. Hate that shit. I've actually seen photos of people who rewired their Classic controller. They drilled a hole in the top.
All right, that's just absurd.
That's hilarious. And, the Classic Controller has that weird thing at the top that it's like an eject button.
Yeah.
But there's nothing to eject
it from. They were originally planning on making it so you could mount the controller to the back of it, the Wii remote, to the back of it. But then they...
Yeah, but it's just so, it doesn't really seem so kind of, half-formed, if you will. It seems so kind of, bizarre. It doesn't seem like it would
It's vestigial.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I think
it is. I mean, it would have made it like a DualShock 3, wouldn't it? Or not a six-axis, It would have made it look like a PlayStation controller, but now it has motion control, too. That would have been funny.
Yeah,
I don't know,
yeah.
I can't really imagine a more awkward controller setup than attaching the Classic controller to a Wii remote
and
waving it around in the air.
And having to wave around with it in your hands. Have you ever done that? Have you ever tried to, use the motion controller with the six-axis?
I've never held
it
a PlayStation 3 controller.
Work. John,
depends on the game. Some games are much better than others.
It depends if it's Lair. So,
I've heard it's great with Flower.
I mean, if you played Lair, I'm sure you would think it's shit. Because it is shit in Lair, from what I've heard.
Okay, well, that's the Classic Pro. I'm somewhat excited about it. I think it's a surprising release for Nintendo.
I would say,
but
the only downside is that this wasn't out at launch.
Yeah, but that's what they always say.
It'll probably be more expensive as well, won't it? I would have thought.
It should be. I honestly think they should just discontinue the Classic controller and release the Classic Pro.
It looks a lot better.
I mean, it seems pretty good for if you haven't bought a second one yet, you know, if you've just got one.
Right.
I think that's,
and I've only got the one.
Yeah, me too.
It's good for me. Okay, that's the end of the news. Now we're going to take a break, and we'll be back with your listener mail. Ahoy, ahoy, we're back with listener mail, and the first one is from Curtis in Connecticut. If and when do you think we will have a universal online system for all three platforms? Whenever a sports game, for example, is released, it's released on the three major platforms. What if Wii users could play against 360 and PS3 owners in a game of NBA Live, for example?
Point. NBA Live, is that even on the Wii?
I think it is at least 1 year. Yeah, I think there's even like an all play version.
Oh, that's right. You're right. Okay. Then the answer is there will never be that time.
The answer still no.
It depends. I mean, it depends because what you have now is Microsoft has a proprietary system with Xbox Live. If, you know, a lot of people think that over time that business will become more difficult as Nintendo's online experience improves and Sony's online experience improves, it's going to be implausible for Microsoft to keep charging people to play online
pay
games.
Service.
So if at some point Microsoft breaks down and Xbox Live becomes a free service, then they don't have as much incentive to barricade cross-platform online play. Now they have, it makes more sense, you know, if the whole thing is advertising based, or they're just trying to get people to buy the Xbox version, because it has nicer graphics or whatever reason, maybe it makes more sense for them to go ahead and allow you to play anybody, because that makes the game more valuable to you, right? You're more likely to play it online if you can play online with more people.
I mean, there are other barriers. Obviously, with the Wii and all that, you know, the differences and in terms of input mechanism, and that's why you haven't seen more cross-platform play between PC and 360, because the infrastructure's there to do it, and there are some games that do it, right? But obviously, the inherent difference between, you know, a shooter with dual analog stick control and PC and mouse control, the kind of built-in disadvantage that's there, means that I don't know how great cross-platform play would be in something like that. And of course, if it's all like the Wii or successors to the Wii, or, you know, versus successors to things, there may not be perfect convergence in, you know, inputs and graphics and all that sort of stuff. So even if some of the kind of just pure online barriers have kind of fallen away, there may still be like these fundamental game design barriers that kind of make it difficult. So you may have to wait for the Dennis Dyack's one console future for this.
Yeah.
And I think another way that this might be possible is like DS to PC cross-platform play. Ooh. And I honestly, thinking about it, if you think about all the casual games that have been released on DS, mm-hmm. Peggle is not really a multiplayer game, but if you think about things like Club Penguin, Pogo Island, some of the other PopCap stuff like Bookworm Adventure could be a multiplayer game. So for certain, you know, flash sort of games, browser type games, I think that is a possibility, and I think that could actually happen.
But that's the thing. See, I mean, in terms of on a case by case basis, there's certain possibilities and all that. But in terms of what Curtis is talking about, a universal online system.
Right. Years away.
You were talking, and I think the problem that certain genres would continue to have problems that all games wouldn't fall into this just raises the likelihood that you would never have an all-encompassing system because it would be so difficult to have one in the first place.
I think to have a system like that, you would have to have the three major manufacturers agree on a standard, and as we've seen.
That's a possibility, though. I mean, it happens with things like Blu-ray versus HD DVD.
In the technology field. Not just in gaming, but in all of in basically any technology
field. It happened with the Rock Band Guitar Hero controllers.
But that's two companies that had people who used to work for each other agreeing.
Yeah, but you know why those are cross-compatible now? It's because Microsoft and Sony said, this is bullshit, and our customers are getting pissed off. When it comes down to it, the platform holders can create these standards and basically force these things to work with each other.
Yeah.
So it's not impossible,
but they'd be forcing
and it's not unprecedented.
And that's
it's unlikely.
I mean, you'd have to see it become, in some sense, commercially desirable. Like you said, at the minute, Microsoft has this sort of niche where it can actually get people to pay for the service because it's like the better one, basically. Mm-hmm. But in time, there will be convergence, presumably, on that.
Yeah, I mean,
and then the commercial imperatives may change with that.
I mean, the only way I could see that this happening is if you had a third party setting up something, like say if everybody started using Steam, right? And so therefore, you know, you kind of take everybody's stake out of it. So everybody's paying the same amount of money to this third-party provider of a network, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, then you don't have any, like, pissing contest over, you know, who gets paid what. So, I mean,
I think that that's going to be an issue, too, because I think they like to leverage the capacities of their online systems against each other. I mean, for God's sake, Sony won't shut the hell up about Home, even though, basically, from what we've seen, is it's not really worth crowing about.
Not at the moment.
Yeah, and to finish off the discussion, one final angle on this is that you do currently, or you're about to have, cross-platform online play between Wii and DS with Final Fantasy Echoes of Time. So, you know, this kind of thing does happen, but it's in very small little bubbles. But I think there is an interest. I mean, that's a product where basically the entire point of the product is the cross-platform multiplayer.
And then
Shadowrun before that, which was a massive failure. I think Echoes of Time will be more successful. But, you know, look at the technical constraints they've had to put on the game in order to make that work. You have a Wii game that is literally a DS game running on Wii. So I'm not sure that's ideal. It seems like they could have done it a somewhat different way. But it is happening if you look for it in the right places, I guess. Anyway, we should move on to the next letter.
So, Piper13 writes, mm-hmm. I've been following your site since the GameCube days, when you were still PGC, and have to say, keep it up. My question to you, however, is this. Even over 2 years after its launch, many still seem surprised at the unexpected, huge success of the Wii. Indeed, I seem to remember back in 2006, many analysts predicted the PS3 would take off the same way the PS2 did before it became the number one. And while the Wii has predicted the fall of a distant third, now the current gen, console race, how different do you think the console universe would be today had the analysts been correct? Do you believe that the Wii would have had the price drop by now,
or even more drastically, might Nintendo have exited the hardware business altogether and forced VR software, like Sega?
They have too much money.
Well, this is like a letter from the ghost of Nintendo past.
Yeah. I would say right now that Sony being the number one console manufacturer of this generation was doomed to begin with.
It was.
Because there was no way in hell it was going to happen. They couldn't get the systems out there to be it if they wanted to. And then when they did, it was just too inordinately expensive. It did
certainly seem like it was their priority. I don't know whether they thought that they were quite happy to ride PS2 for longer, which kind of happened.
I think they just felt like they were in such a position that they couldn't be challenged.
Yeah, there was a sense of sort of insurmountability. And they probably really felt that way about Japan, where 360 and of course they've been obliterated there, so that's that they were certainly wrong about that. I mean, how would it be different? The first thing is there's reason to believe that the gaming industry, the console in particular, would be a lot smaller than it is, because all the figures suggest that most of the recent growth is purely from Nintendo.
Yes,
and in fact, over the last year, the other consoles shrank. Now, presumably, a certain amount, if the Wii had never caught fire in the public imagination or whatever, then presumably some of those sales would transfer to the other consoles, but not necessarily that many, because the whole point is it is getting different people to buy into the Wii, to buy into gaming in general, than would have otherwise been the case. So that's one big thing, is just the industry might have been smaller and poorer.
The thing is, I mean, the Xbox 360 and the PS3, they're serving the same audience ultimately.
Yes,
they're serving the existing audience, and Nintendo came in and they served an entirely different audience. You know how you feel about that? I mean, for better or worse, but
I think there's little question that what Nintendo has done this generation has been good for the industry. Period. Because as you said, if they hadn't done what they did, the industry might not only be not growing, it might be shrinking the way that it had been in Japan.
A lot of elements of sales, especially thanks to Nintendo, have remained robust during the current economic downturn, but companies are facing difficulty getting financing and all that sort of stuff, just like any companies are, regardless of kind of how well they're doing in the market. And if you didn't have the kind of profitability that is possible on Wii, that not necessarily that many companies have actually exploited yet, although there are some examples, but this might actually help see more game developers through this bad time than would otherwise have been the case. So I think it's definitely, that is probably the biggest thing. In terms of the price drop angle, Nintendo were better positioned to drop the price than anybody else, and yet they haven't had to. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's the great thing, that they started at $250, which I remember, at the time when people were talking about the Wii being so similar to the GameCube fundamentally, it was like, well, it should be $199 then. It should be below, just under that psychological barrier of $200.
There's no doubt the Wii is overpriced. It always has been.
Yeah,
it was. For the technology in it, it's too much. But it doesn't matter.
This is 2.5 years later.
Yeah.
Right.
And everything else is tumbling around it, and it's still there. It's still at $250. So had it not immediately caught fire, they had the room to go down, and they weren't going to take huge losses or anything like that. So perhaps in this alternate universe where the Wii isn't an immediate success, they might have actually still been able to succeed in the longer run because they were well positioned to cut price if necessary.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at what they did with GameCube and even N64, they were, despite what Iwata saying about, we have to go big or go home, some of the talk he was making before Wii, if Wii had been a relative failure, they still would have made lemonade out of it.
Right, and they still would have been wealthy as hell for the DS.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Nintendo is that they are a very prudent company in many ways, in that, people go on about the GameCube being a relative failure. Well, they made money on it. That's their flaw, They still end up making money.
I think another thing that would have changed was we would see more Nintendo emphasis on the DS. I think they would be paying much more attention.
I guess so. I mean, we talked earlier in the show about the dearth of original games for it right now. I mean, if the Wii were not, what it is, I suppose you'd have to assume they would be just.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if the DS were their primary source of income, like the GBA was?
Well, it is their primary source, or it has been in some ways, but yeah, I mean, it won't...
But I mean, on that same scale.
Yeah, relatively.
I think we would see them putting out more of their own titles on the system in order to make money.
Mm-hmm. I don't, GBA though, they never really did that so much.
Well,
they
did that. They did that weird porting games over to the GBA thing for a while.
In the early stages, yeah. I mean, later on, they still weren't that prolific, though.
No, but...
You're talking about, like, when they brought over all these Super Nintendo games?
Yeah.
You know, recently I've been doing a little research on the year 2002 for reasons that will go unsaid. And the biggest, other than Metroid Fusion, the biggest GBA games that Nintendo released in 2002 were Super Mario Advance 2, Super Mario Advance 3, and Legend of Zelda Link to the Past, plus Four Swords.
No, exactly. In the early stages, it was very much just the re-release stuff. And even later on, like you had things like Fire Emblem that came over for the first time, and obviously they did a second Advance Wars and stuff like that, but sort of intelligence system stuff, but they never made, you know, new Super Mario Brothers. That never came out on the Game Boy Advance. Yeah, we could have done. But it didn't.
I think right now they've completely abandoned the DS. They haven't, but they're not putting anything out on it.
No, they aren't announcing huge titles for it like they used to.
I think we would see at least one huge title we'd already know is coming if the Wii wasn't
doing I mean, right now, yeah, they probably feel like there's so... not because especially with the Wii, you've got this big user base, but the evidence is a lot of people don't necessarily have that many games.
Right.
So, on the one hand, you know, that's maybe a problem in terms of, like, a little bit of people just buying it for Wii Sports and Wii Fit, and that's it. But on the other hand, it's a big opportunity, you know, and they've got to create software to sell to these people. And so that's probably is where a lot of their concentration is.
I mean, hopefully, where the DS is now is where the Wii is going to be in a couple of years, where the DS... I mean, there are some amazing third-party games coming out for the DS.
Oh, and it's the diversity as well.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, this is a system that's got everything. I mean, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about Contra 4, Space Invaders Extreme, Castlevania, or, you know, the huge
massive quantity of RPGs.
RPGs is just ridiculous now. But, of course, you've got the Touch Generation stuff, you've got the
cooking,
the software app side like Korg, like Cooking Trainer,
DS10.
You know, I mean, it's so broad. I don't know whether the Wii could ever quite be that broad, but I mean, it could be close. I really,
I hope so.
That's what you hope.
All right. Well, I guess we should move on.
All right. Tom in Canberra, Australia writes, "With the oncoming era of downloadable software, I'd like to propose an idea that anyone can claim as theirs, to do with as they will. Make downloadable software exchangeable between individuals. The courts, in their rare wisdom, agreed that the public has ownership of a commodity when purchasing goods, but the download age will reverse that gain. I am technologically challenged, so I'm not sure how it could be done. Maybe an online shop or stored on memory cards to be traded in physical secondhand stores, etc. Fairness has to be won in this bizarro world. So wait till the shitstorm when someone figures it out and see how the corporations react."
Yeah, I think Tom has a really misguided idea of how these digital downloads work, because a standard clause in the download contract that you basically agree to every time you download a game, including through the Wii Shop channel, is that you're pretty much just buying the license to play it and that you don't actually own the game, which means that you have no right to transfer it to another person. So I guess what he's suggesting is like some kind of pawn shop for digital games, you know, whether that be a physical pawn shop or an online pawn shop where you trade games with people or sell your WiiWare games to other people for less than you originally paid. For one thing, it's absolutely not in Nintendo's business interest to ever do that.
No, exactly. I mean, that's the real point.
And they're not legally obligated to allow you to do that either because of the way that they're designed.
Even if they were, they wouldn't be obligated to create a system to facilitate it. So they could make it so it's not, they're not going to get you in trouble for it, but they could still basically make it so you can't do it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're not allowed to do it now. I mean, it's not like you can.
Right. It's not even. It's not even a matter of they're not going to give you a way to do it. If you tried to make your own method of doing this, you would get taken to court, and they would win because that's how they've designed it.
Yeah, that's what you're. I mean, it's a question of what you're buying. Like you said, that's what you're buying is the license to play it and to re-download it in the case of the Wii Chop channel, isn't it really?
Right.
But you know, I mean, that's the thing. Downloadable distribution and all that—it's that's like their great hope to you know cut out the secondhand game industry. To
right.
you know, like there's so many aspects of retail right now that they're not that happy with.
Right, it's literally designed to prevent what Tom is suggesting here.
Exactly. So the thought of that you know market, that secondary market invading the digital realm is like their worst nightmare.
Yeah, that's
the last
that was
thing right. they want. So. I mean, they would kick and scream to never let that happen, and they don't need to, because anyway, so, yeah, that's just the way it is. I mean, because Sony have been really quite proactive, haven't they? You've got these full games that you could just download, like Warhawk and stuff like that, you know, I mean, and I'm sure that is more and more where it's going, and that may be the one thing that will ensure that future Nintendo systems have a slightly bigger fridge than we have now.
Let's hope so.
Yeah, amen to that. So, yeah, not happening.
Are we moving on? Next one?
Yeah.
Yeah. This is from Mario is French in Toronto, Canada, and he writes, the controversial yet probably highly anticipated Mad World is going to be released in 2 weeks. I'm curious, do you personally think that some games have shown excessive and or unnecessary violence? And if so, which games? What is the criteria in which you consider as too violent, and do you agree with me when I say that violence in video games is all arbitrary? What the dealio?
I think we've covered this, and I'd say that yes, there are clearly games that have done this, and the answer
Manhunt. I mean, Mad World is an example of a game that revels in its excessiveness.
Right, but I would say Manhunt, where Manhunt's literally its only selling point was the gruesome ways in which to kill, and I would say that's an instance in which it did go too far.
Well... Okay, I mean, it depends. Like, I kind of sympathize with what he's saying in terms of, you know, violence is arbitrary. It's just a game. It doesn't matter how, you know, how craven it is because it's not real. At the same time, you can't take that position and then say, well, I'm still waiting for the game that will make me cry or the game character that I will truly care about. Or the game that can teach me something, or the game that provides me with some kind of catharsis, or a game that has a real moral that I actually care about. In other words, you can't say that violence or that anything in a game is arbitrary and still look at games as art. Because if it didn't mean anything, then nothing could ever mean anything in a game.
The funny thing is that if you actually had a game with the kind of depth of story and narrative where the characters committing violence wasn't arbitrary, but it was actually meaningful, is that people might actually find that more disturbing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so, I think they would.
Because,
yeah.
So, you know, you wouldn't be talking about the same, you know, assuming this is a credible narrative, you're not going to have, like, crazy No More Heroes level or, you know, Mad World level of violence, but in that lesser quantity of violence, you could actually have something that was far more impactful. And that might actually create more controversy, you know, because it's like anything. I mean, it's like with films. You can have these stupid films with geysers of blood and all that, you know, and that's just kind of silly.
Kill Bill.
Kind of,
it's a comedy.
You know, it's not like, oh, God, it's horrific. You know, people don't.
Yeah, and then you have plenty of movies where one person dies and it's incredibly effective because the game takes it. I mean, the movie takes itself seriously. And I think we've yet to really see that in a video game where, you know, where death is treated as a serious topic. That that is disturbing, that really means something, and I think that's coming. I think that's not that far away.
I would say it probably is, and I think what's it. But you know, in some ways, for game companies, it's so much. You know, people talk about something like Mad World or some of these other things like pushing the envelope, but they're really not because you're so safe there in this where it is arbitrary and it's deliberately excessive stuff. And we only have to look at the fact that Mad World has passed without cuts everywhere. You know, it's in Australia and Europe and all that. It's had no problem, you know, because it's stylized and cartoony and patently ridiculous. So it's excessive, but it doesn't go too far.
Yeah, I think to explain how I would define why I think the two Manhunt games go too far isn't so much the content.
it's the depth of the content that they were explicitly saying, hey, look at these games where you can murder someone. That's the point of the game.
Right. I think some of it is I mean, you could say the same of other games, but I think some of it was the tone as well.
Yeah, definitely.
I think the tonal difference is the big difference of why something like Manhunt faced the censorship issues that it faced, was because it was more along the lines of a kind of psychological horror thing rather than, you know, something cartoony. Like, obviously, I mean, just the visual style, you know, No More Heroes is cel-shaded, Mad World's black and white, and so, you know, apart from that, you've got the kind of tone of the game as well.
Yeah,
I just think it was trying to sell itself as like being disturbing and stuff, like, you know, that was like what it was going for, but it was kind of crass and excessive at the same time. I just think that cocktail is kind of what really touched people off.
I think the methods of killing are different too. I mean, in Mad World, you know, it's not like the methods of killing are...
It's kind of the Acme, you know, Wile E. Coyote stuff.
In Manhunt, there was a method of killing in which you ripped someone's testicles out.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a controller motion mapped to that. I think that sort of thing really set Rockstar up for failure on it. And what blows me away is how they seemed completely dumbfounded at the pushback.
Oh no, well, they were dumbfounded. They might have pretended to be.
Yes,
but they were loving it. They were loving it.
Yeah,
I'm sure they were, because it's kind of goes beyond that game. It's like about their brand and things. You know, we push the envelope. You know, this thing with Lost and Damned and the male nudity and all. You know, I mean, it's all part of the mystique of Rockstar at this point, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
I mean, I guess the point being, like, you know, that they would say, oh, it's not that different from, you know, the torture movies and all that stuff, and it probably isn't. But I guess it's the interactive element that gets people worried about it. But, you know, that's why I think, you know, in games, how serious you can make the tone is more restricted than in films. You know, like, obviously in films, like, you've got the cartoony violence ones is, you know, that you can get away with pretty easily. But, you know, you can do stuff very straight in films that's really disturbing and horrifying, and it'll get in. In games, you're a little more behind on that. Yeah, there isn't that level of acceptance yet.
Well, it's going to be really interesting to see really what happens when Mad World's released, what the reception is like. I don't think it's going to make any huge waves like Manhunt 2 did.
No,
it won't.
But, you know, I mean, one thing we're going to have to ask ourselves is, while we play it, if it wasn't this violent, if it didn't have this much blood, would it still be worth playing?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean, in terms of, like, in terms of answering that before the games come out, the reason why I'm interested in this is because of the platinum pedigree. I mean, it's that simple. I mean, if this is coming from someone else, I'm not interested. I mean,
if this was a Rockstar game...
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, exactly.
The chances are I'm not going to buy. I mean, maybe if it got outstanding reviews,
yeah.
I might. But you know, in terms of just pre-release, for me, this is. I mean, yeah, you know, the graphics are striking and all that, but mostly it's just like, you know, I've played Okami, I've played Beautiful Joe. I love those games; they're excellent, and I want to see what they're going to do on Wii. That's from and so if the game lives up to that pedigree, then we'll be able to say, yes, you know, the violence is all part of the package. You can't really quite abstract it, but it's not the whole package.
No. It tells the story rather than being the story.
Yeah. I think that's where it comes down to. And before we go back to the Manhunt, it is. It's just, look at this. Look what you can do to this guy.
Yeah.
Cut his ear off and feed it to him. Go for it.
And doing it realistically.
But it's, I guess, the difference, like I said, the difference between that and Mad World is the combination of gratuitousness, but without the kind of tongue-in-cheek element.
Right,
like,
and that's huge.
If you're gratuitous but tongue-in-cheek, it's forgivable. If you're not, then...
It's really a fine line, though.
It may be a fine line, but I think it's pretty... Like, if you were to go and play it, you could see, okay, this is clearly on one side or the other.
Well, certainly the difference between it and Mad World is very clear. You know,
right,
because,
and
I mean,
I think here's a good example. Mad World has a lot of blood, but it comes out like geysers.
Yeah,
versus...
and I mean, you're talking about signs like, getting ripped out of the ground. It's, you know, stuff that, you know, like, you as a person could never physically do. Whereas hypothetically, you could do some of the really unpleasant things in Mario. You know, they're not like require superhuman powers or anything. So I think that's where a lot of the issue comes in.
Yeah.
Well, it's an interesting discussion. Yeah, I don't know. Generally, I find that violence doesn't bother me, but it's more like this is a can of worms I don't want to fully jump into right now, but sometimes the lack of violence bothers me when games are set in realistic events, primarily like World War II, Vietnam, things like that, and you have people dying with no blood, for instance,
the
Medal of
Honor.
Yeah,
the sort of sanitization.
That bothers me. I think that's a very ethically questionable and, you know, obviously historically terrible.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fair point. I mean, whether it's that intentional or not, you know, it's a kind of de facto sanitization of something, which should be troubling. In terms of a misrepresentation.
But it kind of gets down to the same root that we're already talking about with these other games, and that it really depends on the tone.
Yeah.
Depends on like how seriously or not seriously do you treat violence in games, and and whether you're respectful of the victims of violence or maybe you're not, and that's the point. All of that plays into it, and it's this. It ends up being this weird alchemy of. Do I find this to be tasteful or not?
Yes.
And, I doubt any of us are advocating any kind of censorship or anything like that. But it's more a matter of like, you know, is Mad World so violent that I don't want to play it?
Right.
No. Does it bother me? Does it make me want to puke? No.
I guess the one thing I would say is in the future, you know, I mean, maybe, you know, when you get to a point, something like Heavy Rain, where you're going to have really photorealistic kind of people and like well acted probably and very sort of thoroughly performed. That level of context that you might have like a real sense of a character and them actually giving a believable performance of being killed, for instance. That kind of thing.
That definitely did not happen in Indigo Prophecy. But I mean, some people die in that game, and it's really very comical. And some of them come back to life, and it's even more comical.
Well,
but, but I'm hoping that they've learned a few lessons.
But hypothetically,
from that.
You know, I could imagine it actually in terms of this idea of it something going too far or crossing a line that people might actually feel more about something like that if someone were to die in a kind of horrific way, but it was really quite impactful because so much of it is just like when you're watching films and people are dying in ostensibly horrific ways, but the acting's not believable. It doesn't have an effect on you. It just doesn't. Whereas
you don't care about the characters. I mean, if the characters are just cardboard cutouts.
Well, that too. I mean, if you're not invested in the characters, obviously the quality of the performance goes to whether you're invested in the character a great deal. It's something like, I mean, Scarface is a pretty silly movie in many ways. But there's one scene where people are getting chainsawed up in front of Pacino. And you don't see them getting chainsawed up. It's actually all off screen. But Pacino sells...
I wouldn't know because I left the room during that part.
Pacino sells
like, that's
the horror.
Kind of shit I cannot handle.
Yeah, Pacino sells the horror of seeing people getting hacked to bits with a chainsaw really well. And he is a tough, crude,
incredibly disturbing,
nasty character. So like, if it's making him feel sick, you know it's horrible. And if you get to that point in video games where you can actually have a performance that can sell something like that so well, even if the violence is actually taking place off screen, you're not even seeing it, you know, it's completely different from the gratuity of Mad World and stuff like that. I think that's where people think maybe it's going too far without actually being excessive. If you see what I mean.
You know, Greg, you've now made me really curious as to whether that scene was desecrated in the Scarface video game. I wonder if they even tried to recreate it.
Yeah, I mean, the Scarface video game, I think, probably embraces the more over-the-top elements of that film, because there are a lot. But that scene is much more gritty than the rest of the movie, actually.
Yeah, it's realistically done, and that's what's so... It's almost out of place in the film.
Yeah, it is, because, I mean, there's so much about the movie that's... Like that is kind of cartoony, like what we've talked about.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, he's like swimming in cocaine, and then he gets up and he shoots 100 guys with his machine gun.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we had some really interesting letters, so thanks to everybody who wrote in, and please keep those coming. You can send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and we love reading those. We love reading them on the air and talking about them. And that's going to be the end of our show, and we'll leave you with just a reminder that we're going to be talking about Eternal Darkness Sanity's Requiem for GameCube next week. So I hope you will join us. You can hit up the forums. There's already an official thread for it in the podcast discussion area. And we will be pulling a few quotes out of there from your forum posts. And we'll be posting in there as well about the game as we play through it. So please participate if you're able to. I think we're going to have a lot of fun with it. And with that, we better wrap it up. See you next week.
Later.
Bye.
Farewell. And now, courtesy of the mix of technical issues and good old-fashioned buffoonery that only RFN can provide, I give you the mother of all stingers.
The control scheme is kind of goofy. It, like, to attack, you have to hold down the fire button because you were using a one-button joystick.
Greg and I are really mature tonight.
Oh, come on, it's funny.
It is funny, John.
The control scheme
we,
is
we...
like... It's like Skype does not want anyone to talk about this game.
Right, Skype is racist against ninjas.
All right, John, I'll just ask questions and hopefully we can get answers out of this one.
All right.
There'll be short answers. Over, under. Just based on the screenshots I've seen, 600 skeletons in the game.
It's a difficult game. I'll leave it at that. If you're a Commodore 64 fan, get it. If not, don't get it. That's pretty much it. Onslaught.
We lost Greg again.
Did Greg just... Oh my god, this show is so doomed. Oh, shit.
We just need to leave all of this in.
I watched Mary Poppins the other day with a German friend who's never seen it before. And I love that movie. But I started to realize just how bad Dick Van Dyke's English accent is in certain parts.
That's the gold standard for bad.
Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, you know, Don Cheadle can try, but he's not quite that bad.
Well,
I want to move to Gotham Road. I've decided I'm going to live on that road, and I'm just gonna call it the Manor.
Call it the cave.
I'm gonna have ladies over. I'll put on the suit.
What, the bat suit or like Bruce Wayne's nice suit?
Both. One under the other.
Sweet. You are the man.
I was hanging out with a friend and he said, "Man, that tree is trippy." And I said, "Perhaps it is not the tree that is trippy, but rather the way we perceive it in which it is trippy." And then I thought, "Man, I should have just said, yeah."
No, it's like from a Diablo kind of isometric perspective. And basically what you're doing is you're taking your guy down like these diagonal sort of pathways and
oh god, we'll never know what it was like.
Just not meant to know.
No, the funny thing is John's already told us like 10 times what it really plays like, and we just can't understand it.
It's kind of like you go with a diagonal and
this is like the movie Nell. John's over here like, tie in the wind, nothing to bury. And he understands what he's saying, but we're completely oblivious. We just think he's mentally retarded.
John.
He's actually speaking his own language.
Why don't you just type it up and I'll read it for you.
I feel like I haven't even said anything.
When he's not talking about the game, there's
okay,
no
it is an action game. It is a ninja game. You're trying to kill a shogun.
I've changed my mind. I want to live on Knob Road.
You're already there, buddy.
It's a Knob Estate.
You know, Dick Van Dyke lived on Knob Estate.
That would be great. Knob Court. That's actually probably better. Knob Court. Knob Lane.
I will say, I've still totally got a crush on Julie Andrews. Mary Poppins, I thought she was gorgeous ever since I was a kid. And looking at it now, I think, man, she's a beautiful woman. She's practically perfect in every way.
Lords of Thunder.
I like how it cut out in the middle of thunder.
I'm starting to think you just blow ass at these games.
Dirk is a total porn name. I mean, you just...
Yeah, because no one's actually named Dirk anymore.
No.
And that's for the guy in
the A-Team? That one guy in the A-Team's name
No, I was going to say Dragon's Lair.
Yes.
Dragon's Lair and porno.
Yep.
David Walsh and U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman criticized the game as cannibalistic and harmful to children underage. Senator Lieberman stated, quote, "It just sends the worst kind of message to kids." The hell message would that be? Don't turn into a fucking zombie?
Don't think independently.
Sends the wrong...
Right. Zombie set a bad example for our children.
What's the name of that? What's the name of that? What's the name of that PS2 game where you play as a dog and you can, like, fart and pee on things?
Just yeah, I mean, they would be resources.
What was that?
Choaniki versus Lords of Thunder.
Yes,
that would kick so much ass.
Yes.
When your days are feeling ordinary, Mary makes you smile so bright. Oh, it's a jolly holiday with Mary. No wonder that it's Mary that we love. When Mary holds your hand, you feel so grand. Your heart starts beating like a big brass band.
This is why Greg's gone.
This is why I drank. And that's The Last Ninja.